been searching for that time to get on some sort of a roll here to get that good feeling, and you need a game like this to give you a chance.
We're still struggling to try and score goals night in and night out, but we've been able to do that in the last couple games.
It doesn't get any easier as the season moves on. Road games get tougher and tougher.
There's not an easy answer to that.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Ezra, Dave, and Drew on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this morning at tsn1290.ca, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. We'll touch on the Winnipeg Jets, the results of last Saturday's NHL draft lottery. We're all over the Stanley Cup playoffs. Tons and tons of NHL discussion and analysis coming at you this morning on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Alongside the man on my far left is Dave Minuk, and the man in the middle, looking handsome as ever, Ezra Ginsberg.
Thanks, Drew.
You're very welcome, handsome Ezra. Handsome Ezra is what I was trying for there. You can follow us on Twitter.
You can call me Ezra if you want.
Okay, I might call you Ezra. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. I might call you Picasso, but we'll deal with that later on in the show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com. While you were sleeping last night, and we're going to talk about the Winnipeg Jets, and we're going to talk about the draft lottery coming up in this hour. But while you were sleeping last night, perfectly reasonable thing to do, a 9:30 puck drop last night between the Oilers and the Ducks in Anaheim, a late game. Oilers jump out to a 3-0 lead. You know, so you're okay, fine. You know, maybe it's the end of the second period, the start of the third period, and you're like, it's, you know, time for me to maybe start to wind it down. Time for me to go to bed. Maybe you even stayed up real late. Maybe you said, okay, I'll watch half the third period. Maybe you said, like you, Ezzy, maybe I'm going to watch 3/4 of the third period. But if you went to bed at the 5-minute mark of the third period with 5 minutes to go, and the Oilers with a 3-0 lead, you missed a hell of an ending.
Silverberg retrieves, gets Lawton, reloads, fires, scores. They got one. Silverberg behind the net. Raquel goes to the front. Fowler takes the shot. Scores! It's a one-goal game! And suddenly, another dramatic momentum shift. Perry with Talbot down and still loose. But back at it. They score! Raquel! Are you watching this?
Has to be complete and utter disbelief with the Oilers and their fans. 3 goals. 3 minutes and 1 second apart.
Darnell Nurse left it in the corner, gets on center. Perry scores! Corey Perry! He saves them for overtime. And Anaheim finally breaks through at home and leads the series.
And so we go to game number 6.
Chris Cuthbert and Jim Houston with the call. The Anaheim Ducks trailing the Edmonton Oilers 3-0 with under 4 minutes to play in the third period. Stage a furious comeback. Score 3 goals in the span of 3 minutes and 1 second to tie the game. And then in double overtime at the 6:57 mark of double overtime around 1:45 a.m. Central Time here in Winnipeg. Corey Perry gets his second of the series. The Anaheim Ducks have a 4-3 win. They lead the series 3-2. Have to start with that fantastic comeback by the Anaheim Ducks last night.
Yeah, Drew, I feel like we could talk about this series for 2 hours. And you mentioned how late this finish was. I watched the first 3 periods of the game, and I'm in bed with Naomi, and I'm telling her, you know, I got to stay up and watch this. We're going to be talking about this on the radio show tomorrow, and it's 3-0. There's 4 minutes left. They go to commercial break, and I say to myself, okay, this game's over. And I wake up, look at my phone. I've got the TSN Go app, and The app gives you those notifications, and it says Corey Perry scores in double overtime. The Anaheim Ducks come back from a 3-goal deficit and win Game 5, right? So what an incredible comeback, right? It's only the second time in NHL history that a team comes back down 3 goals with less than 4 minutes to play and then wins the game in overtime, right? So just an incredible victory. Going into this game, no home team had won a game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Anaheim was all over the Edmonton Oilers in the first period. It was all Cam Talbot in that first period. It's kind of similar to Game 2 when we were talking about it last week, the game in Anaheim, in which the Anaheim Ducks were all over the Edmonton Oilers, and Cam Talbot stopped 39 of 40 shots. And in this game, really, the Ryan Getzlaf show continued. And it was the Connor McDavid show in the second period when we learned that Connor McDavid could play for the Toronto Blue Jays with his bunt goal that he scored. And then he sets up Drake Caggiula on that 3-on-1 goal that made it 3-0 Oilers. And it looked like when it was 3-0 Oilers, guys, that it was really over, right? And this Anaheim Ducks team has shown us that they've been resilient, and so have the Oilers. The Oilers came back from after losing 7-0 to the San Jose Sharks in the first round, and they ended up winning that series in 6 games. But what an incredible performance. And, you know, there was some controversy there on the tying goal with Ryan Kessler, in front of the net, interfering with Cam Talbot and all of that. And then it showed that on the replay that, you know, it was a good goal. And we'll talk to Josh Smith of Scouting the Refs about it after, whether or not we think that was a good goal or not. But it's just an incredible comeback. And, you know, if you think about it, the Anaheim Ducks could have easily been up 3-1 in this series after 4 games, if you consider that the second game, really, I thought, was completely dominated by the Ducks, right?
Sure.
But now they're up 3-2, and it's going to be really tough for the Oilers to come back from this.
You know what? It was just one of those games that you're, like, as he just talked about, it was just so improbable. You're sitting there and you're thinking to yourself, there's no chance. There really is no chance. You know, the Oilers, ironically, were the only other team 20 years ago to have done what Anaheim just did. And kudos to Randy Carlyle. He really did a masterful job. Didn't show any fear in pulling his goalie with 3 minutes to go, yeah, or 4 minutes to go in that third period, down 3-0. And it's funny because you can hear by Chris Cuthbert's call that he sounded like, okay, the Ducks have broken the shutout.
Window dressing.
Right. Like, okay, you know, maybe you'll have something to build on for the next game when you're going back to Edmonton. Not, here's an opportunity. And what more can you say about Ryan Getzlaf? I mean, that's 8 goals. That's more goals than he's ever scored in the playoffs. So, mm-hmm. I mean, think about that. We're only in round 2. Ryan Getzlaf has 8 goals already. He's been unbelievable. Ricardo Kell was very good. Nice birthday for him. Didn't start off very well. But he was instrumental in the Perry OT winner because he pressured Nurse, who coughed it up a little bit soft along the boards and probably had a little more time than he realized. Gave it up to Ryan Getzlaf. And, I mean, you know, Corey Perry hasn't had the best playoffs or the best season, but there was no doubt the chemistry between Ryan Getzlaf and Corey Perry was rather evident on that OT pass, and then that just beautiful wait by Corey Perry to outweigh Talbot and score the OT winner. But, I mean, you know, if you, like you said, as if you didn't stay up for that one, you missed a hell of a hockey game. Because and if you watch the overtimes, both teams had chances to win it. And you know, the Oilers, I think, had a 4-on-1 at one point in OT. So it was a hell of a hockey game. But, again, that's a tough one. You know, there a lot of people, especially if the Oilers end up losing this series, are going to chalk it up to a learning experience. And very well, in a year or 2 years, if the Oilers make some major noise, they're going to look back and point to this series, I suspect, and say that was something that we learned from and built on. But I think that it's going to be a tough pill to swallow if you're an Edmonton Oilers team, knowing that you were probably, you would have been 1 game in your home building away from going to the third round. And instead, now you're, you know, playing for your playoff lives.
Well, you know what it was reminiscent of? And I'm going to come back to the playing with for your playoff lives thing in a second there. But you know what it was reminiscent of? It was reminiscent of the 2013 playoffs, the Leafs and the Bruins, mm-hmm. where the Leafs had the 4-1 lead in Game 7 about halfway through the game, halfway through the third period, rather, and then the Bruins staged that furious comeback and eliminated the Leafs. The Bruins won in overtime. That's the closest thing, or the most recent thing, in terms of a furious comeback of this nature, a 3-goal lead. Even now, even this one was more dramatic than the one between the Bruins and the Leafs because it happened in such a short window of time. That one happened over the last 10 minutes of the game. This happened in the last 3 minutes of the game where the Ducks all of a sudden just throw everything at the Oilers and are able to get those 3 goals past Cam Talbot after he had been so good for the entirety of the game. Dave, you mentioned sort of now the Oilers have to play for their lives on Sunday night at home in game six of this series. Can the Oilers bounce back from this, or is this too demoralizing of a loss? Is this something, I mean, the Ducks have now won three straight in the series. They've been the better of the two teams for a lot of the series, I would argue. Can the Oilers bounce back? Can they send it back to Anaheim for a do-or-die Game 7?
Yeah, they absolutely can, Drew, because they have Connor McDavid, arguably the best offensive player in the league right now at 20 years old, and they also have Cam Talbot, who's been one of the best goalies, so they can absolutely do it. Do I think that they're going to do it? Probably not, because Anaheim has all of the momentum right now, and because Edmonton was up 2-0 in the series, mm-hmm. you almost thought that Edmonton was the favorite, but the Anaheim Ducks won the division, and sure, the Edmonton Oilers only finished a couple of points behind the Ducks for the division lead, but the Anaheim Ducks, I would agree with that, Drew. I think they've been the better team in four of the five games, and you could even argue in the first game, in which the Oilers won 5-3, I believe, that the Ducks, for parts of that game, were the better team. Certainly John Gibson was not very good in that game, allowing five goals, but I would say at the very least four of the five games the Ducks have been the better team. But this game had everything, guys, and you know, I realized that I wasn't able to stay up for the two overtime periods, so I missed, you know, the best part of the game. But earlier in this game, you had Nick Ritchie running Chris Russell, and then you had Nick Ritchie and Zach Cassian dropping the gloves. You don't see fights very often in the playoffs. I believe there have only been seven so far in the playoffs. But this game really, you could tell that either one of these teams, they go down 3-2. It's going to be a lot harder to win the series, right? So there was that desperation from both teams, but the Ducks in the first period were all over the Oilers, and Ryan Getzlaf had the penalty shot. He missed the net, but he also had a partial breakaway earlier in the first period, and Cam Talbot made a great pad save. So the Ducks were the better team in the first period. And then the second period, I mean, Connor McDavid takes over, right? Connor McDavid, you know, has been good in the series, but he hasn't necessarily had the point totals, mm-hmm. but he scores the beautiful goal, baseball bat style, and then he sets up Drake Caggiula there, and he was by far the best forward in the second period. And then when you talk about that third period, the Anaheim Ducks had the pushback, but the Oilers were holding on for dear life. And then with 4 minutes left, they obviously start the comeback with Ryan Getzlaf's point shot. Cam Fowler also scores on the point shot with four players in front of him. Cam Talbot didn't see it.
No.
And then, you know, obviously the third goal by Rickard Rakell was the controversial one.
We're going to talk about the controversy on that goal after the break, because we really want to get into it, because as you mentioned, as we're going to talk to Josh Smith of ScoutingTheRefs.com a little later in the show about a lot of the controversy that's been occurring in these Stanley Cup playoffs. It is definitely worth noting, though, that the Oilers only played last night really with five defensemen for the entirety of the game. Andre Sekera left early in the first period. He only played a minute 54 in the entirety of the game. At a point in time, the Oilers were down to three defensemen because they had lost Sekera with that injury, and I believe that they had
Matthew Benning
yeah. was in the penalty box.
And then Klefbom took a shot in the upper body.
That's right. So they
Chris Russell left as well.
Chris Russell left as well. I think that was in the second period after he got leveled from behind by Nick Ritchie.
Well, actually, earlier in the game, Benoit Pouliot took a shift on defense.
Well, because they were so desperate.
Yeah.
So if you look at the time on ice, and I think this is going to really be, this is going to have a significant impact. I mean, I don't know if Andre Sekera is going to be healthy enough to play game six, but if he didn't come back in game five, sort of hard to believe that, you know, a day later he's going to be healthy again. But Adam Larson played 44 minutes and 58 seconds.
Incredible.
I mean, that's a crazy number.
And you would expect his ice time to be high, Drew, because it went to double overtime.
Sure.
So you'd expect him to be around 30, 32, 34 minutes, but 44 minutes of ice time is incredible. That's got to be close to a record for a defenseman in a game that goes to double overtime. And it's not like, you know, it went late into double overtime.
Yeah.
It ended fairly early in double overtime. Another guy that really impressed me, Drew, Cam Fowler. Cam Fowler missed the entire first round against the Calgary Flames. He plays 35 minutes. The only player on the Ducks that played more was Ryan Kesler, which is also incredible for a forward to play 35 minutes. And that's because obviously he's out there trying to shut down Connor McDavid, right? But Cam Fowler picks up a goal and an assist. And I thought he was a little bit shaky earlier in the series in games one and two. But he
got to get his legs under him and try to get adjusted. You got to get adjusted to Connor McDavid's speed.
Cam Fowler is an amazing defenseman. I've always been a big fan of his game, and he proved yesterday why he is a top-pairing defenseman in the NHL. So I think he deserves a lot of credit for the Anaheim Ducks and their comeback. And, you know, this Ducks defense, we know how good this Ducks defense is. Mm-hmm. And you have a guy like Brandon Montour, who's a rookie defenseman. had a really good season for the San Diego Gulls. Shea Theodore also played for the San Diego Gulls. There's so much depth on this Ducks defense. They're so mobile. And, I mean, look at the shot totals. Cam Talbot ended up with 60 saves in this game, right?
Yeah.
And the shots were 6-0 in double overtime. So, you know, give the Ducks a lot of credit. They deserve to win this game. It might have been a little bit controversial there on the tying goal, but they're a resilient bunch.
Yeah, and the one thing I was going to add on to about Cam Fowler, which was so impressive, was his keeping the puck in the zone on that game-tying goal. Because, that's the one thing, right? Edmonton scored 3 6-on-5 goals.
Mm-hmm.
So they had the net. Anaheim scored
with
three.
With the goal.
With the goalie pulled. Yeah. So, I mean, there were plenty of, and the Oilers had plenty of opportunity to kind of end the game, really, because and put it out of reach by scoring that empty net. And Fowler, I'm not specifically on that play, he just managed to keep the puck in. But like as he said, he played a heck of a good game for a guy who's been a little bit shaky because he's just kind of, as you just said, Drew, getting his legs under him.
And Dave, when you're down to five defensemen, and Adam Larson and Oscar Klefbom are obviously your top pair there, and they're playing big minutes. Once you get into double overtime, I mean, these guys are tired. I don't care how much pizza and Gatorade is going into the body in between the first and second overtime intermission. I mean, these guys are going to wear down eventually.
You play 45 minutes of hockey, of top-flight hockey, do-or-die playoff hockey. It's hard to have the same mental capacity as you get more tired throughout the course of the game as when you start the game when you're 100% fresh.
What a classic game, though, Drew. I mean, this has been the best second-round series by far. I don't think it's even close. I mean, Pittsburgh-Washington has been an entertaining series, but you have Pittsburgh up 3-1. So for me, this has just been one of those classic second-round series. And, you know, whether or not the Oilers do advance, they've shown that, you know, they can go head-to-head with the big boys. And, again, the Anaheim Ducks deserve a lot of credit because they're in win-now mode. They need to go all the way. This isn't a team that's happy just to be there.
When we come back, though, we'll talk about the controversial Ryan Kesler goal last night. We'll talk about the officiating in general throughout the course of these Stanley Cup playoffs. A lot of people unhappy with the job the Stripes are doing. We'll talk about it next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're on the curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Smells like a little double overtime.
Not team spirit?
Team spirit. Maybe not teen spirit. How about team spirit?
Well, there's some teens on this team, maybe.
Would there be any teens on the Ducks still? I don't know. I think they would have all aged out by now. I don't think there's anybody that's... First of all, what do you define as a teenager as? Until 19?
19, Drew.
Is it 19? Is that officially what it is?
19.
Yeah, 19. Oh, yeah. Okay, fair enough.
Well, hold on, Drew. Let me get my copy of Tiger Beat magazine.
I thought you were more of a YM sort of guy there. Anyways, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, Saturday morning here on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by the Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. For more information, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com.
If I'm not mistaken, Shea Theodore would probably be the youngest.
Is he 19?
No, he's 21.
That's what I would have thought. I thought the 19 would be a little young, I thought, for him. So we're talking about the Ducks and the Oilers in the first segment, and sort of now going to talk about the officiating as it has occurred throughout the course of the playoffs. Because last night, a ton of controversy on the game-tying goal by the Ducks.
Nick Ritchie's also 21, by the way.
Okay, there you go. Nick Ritchie as well. Tons of controversy as Ryan Kesler was knocked into Cam Talbot by Darnell Nurse. No argument on that front. But from my perspective, from the perspective of a lot of people, from the perspective of Milan Lucic of the Edmonton Oilers, and I'll read his quote coming up here momentarily, he didn't make any effort to get off of Cam Talbot in a reasonable time. Not only that, but he also tried to hook with his arm Cam Talbot's pad, preventing Talbot from getting up. In your perspective, guys, and I'll read Lucic's quote coming up here in a moment. In your perspective, was that goaltender interference last night, should the Ducks' tying goal have counted?
Well, first of all, I was asleep when that goal was scored, so I only saw the replay, so it's a little bit tough for me to make the best judgment call, right? I mean, Josh Smith of Scouting the Refs is coming up next hour, and he'll be able to answer that question better, Drew. But, I mean, for me, Corey Perry's also in front of the net causing a little bit of havoc in front of Cam Talbot there, but he doesn't touch Cam Talbot. That's pretty clear on the review. So what you're talking about really is what's in question, right? Whether Ryan Kesler tried to get out of the way, or if he hooked his stick. Now, for me, it's more so because there's another Oilers defenseman on him. I'm not sure which defenseman that was on Ryan Kesler, but he's kind of going with Ryan Kesler into the net. So I don't know if you could really say that with definitive certainty that Ryan Kesler wasn't just going in with the Oilers defenseman. But if he's holding Cam Talbot's stick,
his pad, yeah,
then absolutely that's goalie interference. Now, again, I didn't see all the angles. I just saw the replay on SportsCenter. So, I mean, I can't comment on whether or not that was goalie interference. But certainly, Drew, if he was holding Cam Talbot's pad and Cam Talbot wasn't able to move, that's goalie interference.
Dave, before you get in here, here is the quote from the NHL Situation Room about the incident. The NHL Situation Room released a statement saying that the referees determined, quote, that the actions of Darnell Nurse caused Ryan Kesler to contact Cam Talbot before the puck crossed the goal line. So they don't even address the issue about Kesler holding down Talbot's right pad with his hand as Raquel's shot went through the five hole. Here's Milan Lucic of the Edmonton Oilers. Quote, a guy falls on the goalie and wraps his hand around the goalie's pad. I don't even know what goalie interference is anymore, to be perfectly honest. It's an absolute joke that two good referees can't make the right call at the right time, especially when the guy has 2 or 3 seconds to get up and has his hand wrapped around the goalie's leg. The goalie can't get up to make a save, and it's still a goal. Unbelievable.
Okay,
Oilers room was absolutely fuming last night. Frank Saravelli, TSN senior hockey reporter, was on site in Anaheim and said that his writing doesn't do justice to just how mad the Oilers were last night about the sequence of events and the lack of a goaltender interference call that led to the Ducks ending up winning the game in double overtime. Should it have been a goal?
Well, of course they're going to be mad. They lost the game. And you know, Dave and I are watching the replay here in studio, and I mean, it's really tough to see what's going on there. There's four guys in front of the net, so Darnell Nurse was the defenseman. I wasn't sure who the defenseman was, but him and Kesler go into the crease, and there's all types of mayhem going on in front of Cam Talbot. So it's pretty tough to see with certainty what's going on there, right, Drew? Like, I mean, was he holding Talbot's pad? Maybe he was. It's not really clear on the replays that we see on NHL.com, right? So, I mean, maybe if you had a different angle from behind the net or something, you could see that, or if you zoomed in. But, I mean, there was a lot going on in front of Cam Talbot. As I mentioned, there were so many players in front of him there, right? So, I mean, only Cam Talbot and Ryan Kesler really know what was going on there.
But they have... Sorry, Dave, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, I'm looking at it right now in the overhead view, right? You've got Nurse, Larson, Talbot, and then Kesler. And the reality is, Nurse knocks Kesler in, which gives him the ability to be at that spot because he didn't go in out of his own volition. He was pushed in. Mm-hmm. So that kind of gives him legality to be where he is. Now, of course, the impetus is on Kesler to get out of that spot, but Nurse is still jostling with him. So let's be realistic. Ryan Kesler is a veteran NHLer. He knows exactly what to do. He knows exactly the right amount of mayhem. Do I think he crossed the line? Probably, because you could see his elbow does briefly come to rest on Talbot's knee, which, or his pad. So in theory, he could be causing, trying to throw Talbot off. But the fact is that he's got just enough, because of Nurse holding him in there, I think, that kind of gives him that leeway because the ref is standing right on top of it. If he thinks that Kesler is interfering with him, now he may not have the perfect angle because he was behind Talbot, but if he thinks that Kessler's interfering with the goalie at that point, he's going to blow the play dead. He's going to give Kesler a penalty. The fact is, he didn't. He allowed it to continue, and they scored the goal.
But Dave, even from that overhead view, it's really tough to see if Ryan Kesler is holding his pad or holding his jersey, right? It could be the case.
There's one highlight, and it's possible that you guys haven't seen it yet. Maybe they haven't shown it a ton, but there was a freeze frame where you're looking at it right now. There's a freeze frame where you can see Kesler hooking his arm around Talbot's pad. And I think for most people that were watching the game and were watching the replays, that one freeze frame is the definitive angle, the definitive video that says that should not have been a goal. It was goaltender interference. It was a result of that one incident.
And the worst part is that in game four, they didn't call goaltender interference on Corey Perry, right? And Cam Talbot, his famous quote whether he was saying, you know, do I have to start diving? Do I have to start embellishing? Right, Drew?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we've had two games now in this series where there have been non-calls for goaltender interference on Cam Talbot, right? So this has really become the storyline of this series. You know, guys like Ryan Kesler and Corey Perry, you're right, Dave. I mean, these are veteran players. And this is what you have to do to win in the playoffs, right? I mean, go back to 1999 and the controversy with Brett Hull and his skate in the crease. I mean, you have to go to the net. Any coach is going to tell you that you have to make it difficult for the goalie. We've seen that in the New York-Ottawa series, right? They've been all over Craig Anderson, and that's why the Rangers have won the last two games, right? They've made it more difficult. I think that's one of the reasons why that they're now in the series, because in the first couple of games, they just weren't making it difficult enough on Craig Anderson. So for me, Drew, yeah, I mean, if you slow it down and you freeze frame it, maybe there's definitive proof that Ryan Kesler was holding his pad, but it's really tough to see when you're watching it in real time and you're not really freezing it like that and zooming in.
A listener from Texas just tweeted at us with a freeze frame of the picture, and you see Nurse is on the right side of Kesler.
People from Texas are listening.
Everybody listens.
Don't mess with Texas.
We're international. You know that. Nurse is on the right side of Kesler. And then Kesler, with his left arm, which is not being obstructed, not being interfered with whatsoever, reaches out with his left arm to grab Talbot's pad. And there's no reason for Kesler to do that aside from the fact that he wants to interfere with the goaltender.
Right, and with that type of evidence, Drew, it should have been goalie interference then.
It really is clear.
I mean, that's definitive proof.
To me, it's pretty definitive. It's as definitive as you're going to get when it comes to goaltender interference. The problem is that the NHL has created this uncertainty themselves.
But that's a tough one to call. Like, we don't know, did the NHL have that freeze frame view?
Why didn't they? If they didn't, why didn't they? Why do we have it? Why does the TV audience get it, but the NHL doesn't?
You would have to assume that they have it. The fact is that they made a judgment call, and so far, a lot of people in Edmonton land aren't happy with the refereeing in the series. I mean, they don't like the non-icing call that led to a very controversial goal against the Oilers.
That was in game four.
And the fact is there's been a lot of gamesmanship. You know, Randy Carlyle, a veteran coach, had talked about the white gloves treatment and that sort of thing. So, they really have been trying really hard to kind of get the refereeing both on both sides. I don't think this is going to be endearing to the refs from an Oilers perspective, hearing Milan Lucic talk about that. The refs know that kind of stuff. Now, don't think that doesn't mean there may be a memo from the NHL saying, you know, we've got to be a little bit cleaner, we've got to be a little bit better, not making these sorts of errors. But at the same time, you know, you can't have you can't rebeking refs. I mean, everybody who plays any level of hockey knows that the referees have long memories. And if you're calling these guys out, these guys are professionals. Look, people might not like their calls, but the fact is they still have to make they have a job to do. And the fact is that they'll remember that.
And you had so much going on in this game as well, right? Like, we talked about it last segment. I love how we're doing two segments on the series, by the way, Drew. It deserves two segments. But you had Cassian and Nick Ritchie fighting. You had Nick Ritchie taking out Chris Russell. I mean, this has been a very physical series. Ryan Kesler has been draped all over Connor McDavid mm-hmm. for the majority of the series. We know the Ducks are a heavy physical team. So, I mean, there was a lot going on, and these teams hate each other at this point. And so, I mean, there are a lot of emotions, and, you know, you had Andre Sequeira leaving the game, right? So, I mean, it's a tough break for the Oilers.
More on the officiating in the second hour when Josh Smith of ScoutingTheRefs.com joins us. When we come back, Andrew Gross of the Record newspaper in New Jersey. He covers the Devils. He's also covering the Rangers and the Senators. He joins us next to talk about the Devils winning the draft lottery, the return of Ilya Kovalchuk, and the Senators-Rangers series. Much more to come. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Ezra, Dave, and Drew return on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the Record newspaper in New Jersey, we're pleased to welcome back to the program our very good friend Andrew Gross. Andrew, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Morning. Great to talk to you guys.
Likewise, Andrew. Lots to talk about in your world. You're also covering the Rangers-Senators series and, of course, your usual beat, which is the New Jersey Devils beat. We'll start with the Devils. Last Saturday, it was a week ago, they were the big winners in the NHL draft lottery, moving up to that number one position with the opportunity to draft either, likely, either Nolan Patrick or Nico Hischier. From your perspective this early on, is there a leader in the clubhouse for that first overall selection? Most people had it as Nolan Patrick all season long, but Hischier has been able to make a sort of a late run to get his name in the conversation.
Yeah, I still kind of think Nolan Patrick is the leader in the clubhouse. He's a bigger guy. He's probably got a more developed two-way game. So he's got a chance to be really an anchor center for your franchise, which is really, really hard to come back. Hischier obviously has been very, very impressive this season, while Patrick has gone through a lot of injury concerns. And, if teams are not convinced that Patrick's injuries concerns are past him, then I'm sure Hischier, leaps above him. But as of right now, I still think Nolan Patrick is probably the pick at this point. But it's going to be very interesting to talk about over the next 6 weeks or so. You know, it kind of reminds me of when the Islanders had the first pick, and it was, is it going to be John Tavares or not? And it turned out, obviously, the Islanders made the correct pick there.
Andrew, the Devils missed the playoffs this year and finished last in the Eastern Conference with 70 points. So we knew that Ray Shearer had some work to do in this team. Is probably at least a few years away from being a Stanley Cup contender. Getting this first overall pick in the 2017 NHL draft, how much now has this rebuilding process been accelerated?
Yeah, I loved Ray's response after the ping pong balls came up. And basically, paraphrasing, it was like, boy, did we need a win, something along those lines. It is great for the franchise, and especially because this draft, I think we've all gotten spoiled. The last, few drafts have just been, the talent pouring out has been spectacular. And, without any disrespect to Nolan Patrick or Nico Hischier, this draft is not like the last couple of years, which produced, Eichels and Connor McDavids and Austin Matthews and the likes of those players. So, because it's not a deep draft, the fact that the Devils get their pick of the litter, obviously it accelerates it. If they pick sixth or seventh, it really wouldn't have pushed their program as much, obviously. So, yeah, to your point, this does kind of push things ahead. And also, the fact that the Devils may be getting a free asset out of the fact that Ilya Kovalchuk is looking to return to the NHL, whether it's Ilya Kovalchuk coming back to the Devils or more likely, a sign-and-trade and getting some assets, maybe an NHL player and some other draft picks. These are things that can only help and accelerate a franchise's rebuild.
Andrew, you just mentioned Ilya Kovalchuk, and we obviously know that he's been in Russia the last several years. Have you been able to talk to the New Jersey Devils about the possibility of Ilya Kovalchuk coming back, and what would those terms look like?
No. Well, I mean, they won't be the 15-year, $100 million contract, that's for sure. I mean, obviously, it does not behoove the Devils at this point to make any comments until, Ilya's plans are set. I mean, my understanding is that, Kovey does want to come back to the NHL, and preparations are being made to make that happen. From the Devils' point of view, obviously, you talk to his representatives and get a sense of what Kovey is thinking. Now, there are reports that he wants to stay in the New York area, which, maybe that does lend itself to believe that, he would want to come back to the Devils. But at age 34, if he's coming back to the NHL, I really got to believe that he's going to want to go to a team that's a little further along in their process right now and play for a more legitimate Stanley Cup contender. And again, like I said, either way is a win for the Devils, because if you look at the team, there are two glaring needs amongst a long list of needs. Is you need a top four defenseman, probably a top pair defenseman, and you need a winger in the top six, at least one who's going to provide, you know, more scoring. And Kovalchuk, you know, that's his resume, right? That he's going to play on one of the top two lines and be a sniper. So if he comes back to the Devils, great. You know, you fill that without having to give up any assets. But more likely, if Kovey wants to go to a contender, it's sort of like when the Devils picked up P.A. Parenteau off waivers from the Islanders right before the season. It was a free asset, and they wound up getting draft choice for it. And I think Kovey, you know, sign and trade, you get back some usable parts or some future draft picks that really can help this team's rebuild.
Andrew, switching over to the Rangers-Senators series, which you've been obviously covering, how impactful was the insertion of Tanner Glass back into the lineup after being a healthy scratch up until Game 3?
Yeah, you know, it's funny with Tanner. I mean, this guy's game never changes. He literally brings the same thing to every game he plays. It's only the perception of him that changes. For whatever reason, Ranger fans have been down on this guy since he signed. But, you know, he comes back in and he does make an impact. He does boost the energy level. And you could see it in the Rangers' play. And it also, you know, and all of a sudden this guy gets, you know, a couple of assists in two games. And the fourth line is the Rangers' best line. And now this guy's being cheered wildly, you know, every time his name is announced. So, like I said, I mean, I've always appreciated Tanner Glass's game. You know, maybe it's not, you know, obviously he was in the minors most of the season, so it's not you put him in an NHL lineup all 82 games. But when this guy is in, you know exactly what you're going to get. And he's also a great guy in the room, and he really does have an impact on a team. And it's nice to see what he brings being appreciated, at least for the moment.
Andrew Gross is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Andrew is covering the Rangers-Senators series for the Record newspaper in New Jersey. Andrew, Game 5 of that series goes this afternoon back in Ottawa. It's been a series dominated by the home team so far. You know, obviously the Senators winning two on home ice, the Rangers coming back and winning two at Madison Square Garden. Are the Rangers entering this Game 5 today sort of with the mentality that, truthfully, they should have a 3-1 series lead given how they blew Game 2 back in Ottawa and that they've been maybe the better of the two teams thus far this series?
I certainly believe they think they've been the better team. If, you know, certainly the last two games for probably the first two periods in Game 2 and, you know, not so much in Game 1. So I would say they think they've been the better team, but I don't think it's with a cockiness or an overconfidence. It's just kind of an understanding that if they continue playing the way they're playing, then they should be able to come out with a win, be it on home ice or on the road. And, you know, the Rangers actually have been a much better road team than a home team this season. They won 2 of 3 in the first round at Montreal, and they had a league-high 27 road wins during the regular season. So I really don't think, you know, going back to Ottawa and being able to get a win is a huge hurdle for them to leap over. If they, you know, if they continue to play disciplined and they continue to be able to get production from four lines, I just think at this point they're a more talented and better team than the Senators right now.
Andrew, we have to ask you about Rick Nash. He scored that big goal in Game 3 at MSG. He had a bit of a rough season. He missed some time and had a bit of a down year by his standards. Is this maybe the best that you've ever seen Rick Nash play for the Rangers in the playoffs?
Yeah, I would say so. He's, you know, you don't hear that talk anymore that Rick Nash can't play in the playoffs, which was just such a huge cloud over him over, you know, in his first few runs with the Rangers. Obviously, the expectations when you bring in a guy like Rick Nash is for him to be able to propel you in the playoffs. And, you know, we've been over this, but Rick did everything but score in the playoffs. And, you know, but he doesn't want to hear about how good his defense was in the playoffs. He wants to be able to bring point production. And he's just skating really strong. I think he's very healthy. And, you know, he's getting to the net and he's beating defensemen, you know, around the edge. And when things are going well for Rick Nash, that's how he plays. And, you know, it's kind of lifting up his line mates right now because they know they can get him in the puck and they know where the puck's going to wind up.
Andrew, somewhat overshadowed by all the Rangers scoring was the play of Henrik Lundqvist. What have you seen from the Rangers star netminder the last couple of games?
Yeah, obviously he was great in game one, didn't wind up winning that. Kind of a fluky goal by Erik Karlsson for a 2-1 Senators win. And, you know, he was neither him nor Anderson were good really in game two. A little bit surprising. But Henrik, you know, he was not overly taxed in either games three or four. But when he had to come up with the big, big save, he was there for the Rangers. So, you know, I think his game is exactly where it needs to be right now. And you know what? One of the things that's helping Henrik out right now is the fact that the Rangers concentrated on getting more support down to the crease, specifically having the wingers come down and helping out with boxing out. And that's the structure that the Rangers have shown defensively the last two games has been very, very strong. And I think that's another reason why Hank's been able to get back and find, you know, the game that he needs to play, which is deep in the net, which is, you know, straight up to the puck and he's getting side to side quickly. So, there are no issues with Hank right now.
Andrew, Ryan McDonagh and Dan Girardi is obviously the top pair for Alain Vigneault and the New York Rangers. One of the defensemen that's probably impressed me the most for the Rangers during the season and the postseason has been Brady Shea. He's a rookie defenseman, scored 39 points during the regular season. He's got 4 goals in the postseason, paired up with Brendan Smith on that third pair. How surprised have you been the way he's handled his first postseason experience? And Alain Vigneault, the way he's been not hesitant to play him 18, 19, 20 minutes a game.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. This is kind of to be expected from Brady Shea. And just to circle back, he actually did play in the 5-game loss to the Penguins in the first round last year. So I thought coming into this playoffs, you know, that experience, even though it was such a dreary playoff series for the Rangers, at least, you know, Brady wasn't being thrown into the deep end. I mean, ever since the first time we saw this kid, it was apparent that he was right out of the mold of a Ryan McDonagh. You know, maybe he wasn't going to be quite as good as Ryan McDonagh, but there's a chance he can be because he does the same things. He's a great skater. He's physical. He plays well, you know, in all three zones. And he's a big body that's tough to move. And he sees the ice really, really well. And he wants to get up into the attack. So, you know, every time I talk to him, you don't even think of him as a rookie because he's engaging, but he's very, you know, calm and poised and sure of himself and sure of the way he needs to play. So, you know, to be fair, this is pretty much what I expected out of a Brady Shea.
Andrew, we'll let you go on this last question. If you look back to game four, the Rangers only had one player who played more than 20 minutes. That was Ryan McDonagh up at 25-14. Conversely, they didn't have anybody in single digits. The least amount of ice time was Tanner Glass with 10 minutes and 16 seconds. The Rangers' ability to roll four lines and sort of have balanced ice time, do you think that could be a differentiating factor over the last three games, their depth and the ability to keep everybody fresh for the final stretch in the series?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a great point, and Alain Vigneault has done and his staff has done a really good job of meeting out the ice time, and the Rangers' depth has allowed them to roll four lines. You know, in the Canadian series, it was when the rookie Pavel Buchnevich came in after a couple of games for Tanner Glass, that AV was really able to start rolling four lines a little bit more. And now with Tanner back in for Buchnevich, that's continued. And, you know, we were talking to Tanner after game four. He was talking about, I was asking him about the fact that the Rangers seem to be really wearing down the Senators. And I think that does speak to their depth, that, you know, the Rangers can play physically and go hard because the ice time is being shared so equally. And, you know, Tanner agreed 100% that he thought, you know, every body check the Rangers were laying on the Senators was going to pay dividends, you know, games 5, 6, and possibly 7. That as he called it, it was a war of attrition, and he did seem to think the Rangers were winning that.
Andrew Gross covers the New York Rangers and the New Jersey Devils for the Record newspaper in New Jersey. You can read his work at northjersey.com. Andrew, always appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. It's great talking to you. You guys have a good one.
Likewise, Andrew. We'll do it again soon. Let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to discuss the Rangers-Senators series. Game 5 goes this afternoon in the nation's capital. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Now you're on the curve on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
We're 2-2 going back home. Obviously, the past two games haven't been what we wanted. We want to get off to a lot better start, but that's all things that we can focus on for tomorrow at home. Tense playoff hockey. It's competitive, it's intense, and at the end of the day, everything kind of boils over, so that's part of the fun.
The Rangers and the Senators, that series deadlocked at 2 games apiece, each team winning on home ice. Game 5 this afternoon in Ottawa, our nation's capital. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment is brought to you by our good friends at Keener Jerseys. Keener Jerseys is known as one of the world's best jersey customizers. If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team, or if you have a jersey you want personalized, visit Keener Jerseys online at keenerjerseys.com. Check out their new showroom, 982 Portage Avenue. Tell them Illegal Curve sent you. Keener Jerseys in the process, making some nice new jerseys for the House of Ashkenazi, our softball team, Dave. The yep. Jerseys, great to deal with them in the course of have been sort of coordinating this whole thing. They've been fantastic to deal with. Great line, great selection, great options. Whatever you want in terms of customization, they can do it for you. Check them out, Keener Jerseys online at 982 Portage Avenue. The Rangers and the Senators, sort of, it's a 2-2 series that, as I mentioned and as I asked Andrew about, Rangers sort of have to think that they should be in the driver's seat right now. I mean, when it's 2-2, you're in a best of three, you can go any which way.
Well, they could be up 3-1 in the series if it wasn't for J.G. Pageau's 4 goals.
Well, and the Rangers blowing a 5-3 lead late in that game.
Right.
I mean, the Rangers had that game in hand, except for the fact that nobody can, you know, hold on to a 2-goal lead in these playoffs. That was late in the game, and the Senators score those 2 goals, and then Pageau wins it in overtime. The Rangers have to be kicking themselves that they aren't up 3-1 at this point in the series.
Yeah, and let's be honest here, guys. Henrik Lundqvist was not good in Game 2, and he's been excellent in Games 3 and 4, right? But for me, the Rangers have been the better team in this series, and it's not really close. And I thought it was going to be much closer, but, you know, you have 12 different goal scorers for the Rangers in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And Mika Zibanejad leads the Rangers in scoring right now, and he's only got 1 goal.
1 goal, 6 right? assists, 7 points.
Yeah, so it's been scoring by committee for the New York Rangers, and the New York Rangers don't have a Sidney Crosby or Connor McDavid or Evgeny Malkin. So, I mean, you are going to have balanced scoring. You expected that, right? But Henrik Lundqvist has been excellent. And I think when you look at the Ottawa Senators, but what's the biggest difference between the Senators this year and the Senators the last couple of years? It's like Guy Boucher's brought in that 1-3-1 defensive system, right? That left wing lock, whatever you want to call it. And the Rangers, I think Alain Vigneault, by the way, has outcoached Guy Boucher in this series. They found a way to get through that, and it's really been with speed through the neutral zone, right? Mm-hmm. It's been way too easy for the Rangers in the neutral zone in those 2 games, and even game 2 at Canadian Tire Center. I mean,
they're calling it what, the Canada Wall, right? Is what they were previously
right.
calling it.
And how you get through that is short passes and speed through the neutral zone, right? I mean, we've seen that in the Olympics when Germany did that to Canada when you want to line up guys at the blue line. But this Rangers team, guys, is one of the faster teams. And you think of, you know, fast teams, you think of the Pittsburgh Penguins, but that Rangers Habs series, that was a fast series because the Habs are a fast team as well. So when you have speedy guys like Matt Zuccarello and Michael Grabner and Rick Nash and Derek Stepan, Mika Zibanejad's a fast skater. I mean, these guys have found a way to get around that clogged up neutral zone, right? So, I mean, give the Rangers a lot of credit here. I mean, I think they're going to lose to the Pittsburgh Penguins or the Washington Capitals in the next round, most likely the Pittsburgh Penguins. But, I mean, the Ottawa Senators right now, first off, they're not scoring any goals. I mean, they need to start scoring goals. And,
yeah, one goal in each of the last two games.
Yeah, and I also thought, Drew, in that game four, I mean, the New York Rangers were getting all over the Ottawa Senators defense, and the Ottawa Senators were getting frustrated. And you saw a couple fights there in the third period. Brendan Smith fought Dion Phaneuf, and then you had the unlikely Kyle Turris Tanner Glass scrap.
Well, I mean, not so unlikely for the Tanner Glass part of it, but Kyle Turris is certainly not known for his fisticuffs by any stretch of the imagination.
And Tanner Glass had the partial Gordie Howe hat trick with two assists and a fight, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, I thought the Senators are not a scrappy physical team. That's not their style. I mean, they have guys like Mark Borowiecki and a guy like Zach Smith, and, you know, Dion Phaneuf can mix it up a little bit. They have guys that can play that physical style, but this is a skilled team, Dave, and I thought that they were really playing into the Rangers' hands in that regard.
Yeah, I absolutely. As I think that you lose when you try and match up in that way when you're trying to be something you're not, then it causes a problem because it's really throwing what your team is off kilter. And I think the fact of the matter is that when Erik Karlsson doesn't play the final period, that's worrisome. Now, there are indications he might play today.
Yeah, they say that if it had been a close game, he would have played.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably a smart decision at that point by Guy Boucher to
wave the white
to
flag.
Yeah, exactly, and say, okay, I'm going to rest him up. Because Game 5 is critical. 80%, almost 80% of teams that win Game 5 go on to win the series. So the fact is that you know that if you can win this game, and every game so far is won by the home team, regardless of whether they should or shouldn't have won, it has been that way. So if Ottawa's thinking, okay, we've got to take it back to Ottawa and win this game five, then they made the right decision by sitting Karlsson. Although, you know, we saw in the comeback in Anaheim, comebacks are possible even when you're down by three. But, you know, that's definitely a concern. I mean, obviously they pulled Anderson for the third period as well to give him some time off from that game and to allow him to kind of rest up for this afternoon's game. It's just a problem. Like, I think the Rangers are already smelling the blood is in the water. I think that this is a veteran team that sees that Ottawa isn't firing on all cylinders, doesn't have maybe the same balance as New York does, and they're ripe for the picking.
Well, you know, if you're the Senators, though, on the flip side, you're the Senators, you say, well, we've only played well really in one game, which was game one, and that was even a toss-up. I mean, it was a sort of a fluky game-winning goal, Karlsson from, you know, really the goal line. So the Senators haven't played very well in the series, and look, it's 2-2. So they have to be saying, we haven't given our best effort, we haven't played our A game yet, and we're right in the series. So if you're the Ottawa Senators, now the question is, can they flip that switch and get up to their A game and start to neutralize what New York has been doing to them? And that's been, I mean, they've been hitting Erik Karlsson at every given opportunity. You come in on the forecheck, you throw your body against Erik Karlsson. You see guys like Matt Zuccarello, who's just, you know, a water bug out there, throwing his body against Erik Karlsson to try and knock him off his game. The Senators have to be saying, we haven't played that well and we're still right in it.
Yeah, and similar to the Montreal Canadiens towards the end of that series against the Rangers, you're going to have to get offense from your veteran players and the players that you expect to contribute offensively, right? Mm-hmm. So you're talking about Derek Brassard and you're talking about Bobby Ryan, who were very good in the first round series against Boston. Both of those players have not scored a goal in this series, right? I believe Derek Brassard's got one assist and Bobby Ryan doesn't have any points. And you've got Mark Stone, a guy who's really provided a lot of offense for the Ottawa Senators. He hasn't played very well in the playoffs for the Senators either. So J.G. Pageau and Kyle Turris have been their best forwards in this series. But aside from that, I mean, you're not getting a lot of offense as of late from Erik Karlsson, right? Earlier in the series, you were. He got the overtime winner, the game winner in game one. But I mean, the Senators just need more of an offensive spark, in my opinion, and they're just not getting it right now. So it has to come from your big dogs like Brassard and Ryan. I think Kyle Turris has had a nice series, and J.G. Pageau's got five goals in this series, including four in game two. So, I mean, J.G. Pageau, you can't expect all of your goals to come from him, but it's got to come from other sources, Drew.
Yeah, no goals in the series for Mike Hoffman. No goals in the or one goal in the series for Mark Stone. No goals for Bobby Ryan. You're absolutely right, Ezzy. None for Derek Brassard either. No points for Derek Brassard through four games in this series. It'll be interesting. The Senators and the Rangers Game 5 goes this afternoon in Ottawa. When we come back, Michael Trakos of Post Media joins us. We'll talk about all the series. We'll talk about the Penguins and the Capitals. Tons more to come. Your hour number two up next on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
You're on the Curve on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel and Dave Minuk with you in studio. Ezra Ginsberg's warming up his coffee.
Yeah, he's not in the studio. He's in the building.
He's in the building. He'll be back in studio momentarily. He likes to warm up his coffee multiple times in the course of the program. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to our program our very good friend, Michael Trakos. Michael is the national hockey writer for Post Media Network. You can read his work throughout the country in the National Post and in the Sun Media newspapers. Michael, good morning. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, guys. How are you doing this morning?
Doing very well, Michael. How about yourself?
I'm all right. Didn't get a whole lot of sleep watching that game last night, and
that's what I was going to say.
Probably,
I mean, it was glad
I didn't turn it off.
Yeah, it was 1:45 in the morning here in Winnipeg, so 2:45 a.m. Eastern is a pretty late night to watch a hockey game.
Playoffs, baby, because of the cup, right?
That's right. Go big or go home. I like that attitude. So let's start with that game last night, Michael. Goaltender interference on that tying goal, by your estimation, did the NHL, the off-ice officials, the on-ice officials, did they blow that call?
Ryan Kessler basically put Talbot in what's probably known in Western Canada as like a sharpshooter there. So, I don't know. It seemed like he had fist hooked them pretty well. I think that's goalie interference. But yet again, the rules around goalie interference seem to be kind of made up on the fly. So what is goalie interference one day or even in the first period isn't goalie interference later on in the game. So if someone can find the actual ruling and stick to it, it'd be nice, because I think players, officials, and fans are just confused as to what constitutes a goalie interference penalty these days.
Did the NHL make this mess by themselves? I mean, they bring in this video review. It's such a subjective call. It's like, you know, doing video review on pass interference, which right. I know the CFL does, but I mean, it's so subjective that it seems like the NHL, you know, reaped what they sowed by bringing this, you know, video review goaltender interference question into question in the first place.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that, but I think a lot of us at home are pretty clear as to what we think is goalie interference. And when you've got replays and slow-mo, there shouldn't be any kind of, well, there shouldn't be continued mistakes yet and yet again. Like, you watch that replay and you see Ryan Kessler is wrapping his arm around Talbot's pad and holding them down. Okay, well, it's fine. If they say, you know what, that's not goalie interference, then stick with that. And, like, There should be like a precedent set in the sense that, okay, you can do that. And whereas next call and this happens, it just seems like we're back at square one and they're just kind of making it up on the fly. And it reminds me a lot of what we see with the Department of Player Safety, where one hit is worthy of a 2-game or 3-game suspension, and that same hit is not worthy of the same suspension. And then we come back again, and okay, now this guy's getting 8 games. It just seems like they're spinning a wheel where they don't really have any rhyme or reason why they're calling it. It just seems like they wake up one day and they say, okay, well, that's goalie interference. Okay, the next day, well, it's not.
Now, Michael, the captains, I thought, really took over that game yesterday. Connor McDavid had a goal and an assist in the second period, and then Ryan Getzlaf started the comeback in the third period. He's got 8 points in the last 3 games. He's got 15 points now in the playoffs. Is there any doubt that he's the Conn Smythe Trophy favorite right now?
there's a lot. Like, I kind of tweeted about it yesterday, and, like, you'd have to put Marc-Andre Fleury's name definitely there as well, because the Penguins are getting shelled almost nightly, and the reason why Washington's trailing in the series is because of Fleury, and you look at Malkin's play and Jake Gensel, who's got, I think, what, 8 goals now. Those guys are worthy. If Ottawa were able to get past the Rangers and that series is tied 2-2, I don't know how Eric Karlsson's also not a Conn Smythe favorite right now. So there's a lot of guys. And you look at Nashville, and that's a series that probably is not going and not getting as much attention as some of the others. And you look at Pekka-Rinne's play and Ryan Ellis and Roman Josi, like, those guys have just been on fire. So, but yeah, to answer your question, yeah, Getzlaf has just been a beast. And it's not just in the playoffs. Like, in the last 2 months of the regular season, this guy was arguably one of the best players in the NHL. And I think right now, a lot of us that don't get to see a whole lot of Anaheim Ducks games are really appreciating just how strong of a player he is down the middle. Like, and he single-handedly has basically got Anaheim a 3-2 lead in the series.
Michael, with the Penguins up 3-1 right now over the Capitals, do you think they may would be making a mistake rushing Sidney Crosby back if he plays for Game 5?
I know. I kind of wrestle with this. I think, yes. I think there's no need to have him in there, and yet a lot of sports people would say, you know what, when you've got an opponent down, you really got to finish him off, and maybe the danger is you let Washington kind of creep back in the series. So, you know, Sidney Crosby, hopefully he's getting great advice from his doctors and from the team management. He knows his body better than anyone, so I don't want to be that guy to say, oh, he shouldn't play hockey again, or he should rest. Like, you know, I guess leave it up to him. But in the same sense, this is a war of attrition. Like, you want Sidney Crosby not just for this series. You want him for the Stanley Cup final if you get that far. So I guess what's the harm in resting him and possibly saving him for the next round, which could come a week from now? That would be the perfect scenario, I think, in everyone's mind. And yet, yeah, the last thing you want is from Washington to kind of get some momentum and really put Pittsburgh on its heels.
Michael Trakos is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Michael is the national hockey writer for Post Media Network. Michael, if the Capitals go out, be it in 5 and 6, maybe they come back and make it a 7-game series, how, you know, do they have to do something to the core of the team, or is it just something they chalk up to the Penguins having their number, and, you know, maybe next year they don't meet the Penguins and then they're able to get past them? I mean, it seems like the Penguins are the bugaboo, but I don't know how the Capitals get over that.
Well, it's very similar to what San Jose went through for a number of years. And what did it take there? Well, Joe Thornton gets stripped of the captaincy. They didn't really make a whole lot of changes to the core, but basically it was just a matter of finally kind of finding that breakthrough. And you know what, it's like, you look at Alex Ovechkin, and has he been a bad player or even a bad leader? I don't think so. You look at his points per game in the playoffs, and he's basically a point per game guy. He's producing in these playoffs, so you can't really blame him. You'd like him to be better, and yet when you watch the game, it's not like he's letting in a whole lot of soft goals. It's just that Marc-Andre Fleury is playing that much better than him. So it's difficult. Like, they're going to lose some guys just through free agency this year. Like, Shattenkirk's not going to be back. TJ Oshie's a UFA, so is Justin Williams. And then on defense, Carl Alzner is also a UFA. So naturally, you're going to have just some turnover. And maybe that's not the core. You're still going to have Backstrom back. You're going to still have Kuznetsov, and you're probably going to still have Ovechkin. I don't see them moving away from that. And Holtby is a two-time now, two in a row Vezina finalist, where he wins the Vezina 2 years ago. So I wouldn't blow things up. And I think that's probably going through their mind. Like, you're not going to fire Barry Trotz. The guy's been money in the regular season, and I don't think he's getting out-coached by Mike Sullivan by any stretch. It's just a matter of, and fans don't want to hear it, it's just bad luck right now. And they're running into a team in Pittsburgh that just is firing on all cylinders, even with all the roster depletions that they're going through.
Michael, the Rangers and Senators game 5 goes this afternoon. The Rangers have outscored the Senators 8-2 in those two games at MSG. Looks like they're in control of this series right now. We'll see what happens and see if Ottawa can win Game 5. But in the next round, how much of a chance do you give the Rangers or the Senators against the Penguins?
That's a really good question. I haven't really thought about, like, what the next round's going to look like. you think that the way that Hank is playing, Henrik Lundqvist, and that whoever, well, for the Rangers get past the Senators, they're going to give whoever they face, whether it's Pittsburgh or Washington, looking like it's Pittsburgh, they're going to give him a run for their money. And I don't know, like, for whatever reason, it feels like this Pittsburgh-Washington series was going to be the winner of it was just naturally just going to go to the Cup. But it doesn't always work out that way. And maybe, yeah, they're going to run into a hot Ottawa team or a hot New York team. You know, I still like Pittsburgh. Right now, what I'm seeing out of them, without Crosby in the lineup, even without Chris Letang, without Matt Murray, this is a team that just has so much depth and so much belief. They almost remind me of the Chicago Blackhawks team, where they just keep losing players, and yet other guys step up that you've never even heard of before. And this year, it's Jake Guentzel. Last year, it was Connor Sheary. For whatever reason, they're just able to kind of plug in guys, and they're playing above what maybe a lot of people expected out of them. So I don't think New York or Ottawa has got a chance really against them. And you know what? My predictions have been going up in smoke these playoffs, so what do I know?
Well, that's for a lot of people, I think, Michael. But so one thing you wrote about, and I thought it was really interesting, was about the Russians coming over from the KHL and how they're not coming right. as younger players, but they're coming more as older players. At what point do you think we started to see that shift, and how much of an impact will those players now have in the NHL?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Like we've seen it in the last couple of years now with Panarin coming over when he was 24 as a rookie and winning the Calder and this season, Nikita Zaitsev for Toronto as a 23-year-old defenseman. These guys are coming in as impact players, and it's smart because, you know what, the biggest fear for GMs was a Russian comes over, and we saw it kind of with Vancouver this year with Triamkin, and they're not quite ready, and they need some seasoning, and they want to send these guys down to the minors, and their agent says, well, if that's the case, we're going to send this guy back to the KHL, and that's the big fear. It's like, okay, well, yeah, we'll plug him in the lineup. And, you know, it's a bad scenario for the player. It's a bad scenario for the team. So what's happening now is teams are saying, you know what, rather than come here as a 19, 20, 21-year-old and you're going to have to bounce up and down the minors and that's not going to work, stay there, get your game all sorted out, and come when you're a little bit more physically mature and your game is more mature as a 23, 24-year-old. And, you know what, just come in, step in as an impact player. You know, we're seeing that time and time again where it seems like this is a better measure of success. Like, Evgeny Kuznetsov did the same kind of thing. And now with Vadim, I think it's like Shipachov, being signed from to Las Vegas. This guy's 30 years old. He's already led, I think, the KHL in scoring, their top three last 2 years, won championships. So he's coming over to the NHL, and I guess there's not going to be that learning curve. Like, this guy is already an established player. So I think this is the new model where it makes Russian players happy because they can kind of take their time and develop their game, and it makes NHL GMs happy because they don't have to go through that losing a player back and forth and kind of rushing him into the lineup where he shouldn't actually be.
So, Michael, then, just a follow-up then, it seems like that would essentially turn the KHL into a Russian version of the AHL, and I guess yep. that would make the NHL happy and the teams happy, but how would that leave it with the KHL? I can't imagine they're very happy having developed these players and then losing them over to the NHL.
Yeah, but you got to think, like, they get these players for another 3 years, whereas they might have lost them a little earlier, and even the KHL should be happy that these guys aren't leaving early to go to Major Junior. And we're seeing less and less Russians in the Major Junior leagues now as well. So, you know what? Maybe they don't like being a feeder system, but they're going to lose the players regardless. Like, it's pretty clear that the KHL is no longer that big threat that the NHL maybe perceived it was going to be when it first opened up in 2008. Like, if anything, the KHL is arguably at a lesser level than even the Swedish Elite League over in Europe. So, you know, to get a guy, to get like some young, good talent, and there's a guy this year's draft, Klim Kostin, who's supposed to go in the top 10, chances are he's going to get drafted and he's still going to play over in Russia. So they're going to get a couple more years out of this guy versus in the past where these guys were coming right over as young as 18 years old. You're losing them then, and then you're just getting that kind of bounce back effect where they don't know if this guy's going to keep his contract in the KHL, if he's going to break it, or if he's going to go back and forth. And I think there's a lot more clarity these days.
Michael, last night, Jaden Schwartz's goal in the third period extended the series between the Predators and the Blues. Are you prepared to say that the Blues are back in the series, or do you think the Predators have this one locked up?
I think they're delaying the inevitable there. I think Nashville has got this one locked up. I was actually surprised that it wasn't over last night. Good on St. Louis for not going down quietly. Maybe they'll make a bit more of a series out of this, but I'm still predicting a Nashville win. Right now I'm thinking Nashville-Pittsburgh for my Stanley Cup final. The way it's going, I think Nashville, with the way that Rene's playing, with how strong their defense is, I think they're going to roll past St. Louis still, and I think they're going to roll past whether it's Anaheim or Edmonton in the next round.
Michael Trakos is the national hockey writer for Post Media Network. Michael, always appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks for doing this morning.
Perfect, guys. Thanks. Have a good weekend.
Likewise, we'll do it again soon. Let's head to break. When we come back, we'll talk on the Penguins and Capitals series. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
On the Curve, on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Obviously, I didn't play my game at all tonight. So, I think me personally, I have to play much better.
Washington Capitals captain Alex Ovechkin after Game 4. Capitals down 3-1 to the Pittsburgh Penguins. A Game 4 defeat. The Penguins playing without Sidney Crosby makes no matter, as they're able to defeat the Capitals. They have them on the ropes with Game 5 going back tonight in Washington later on this evening. This segment of the show, it's brought to you by the Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. So as we talk about the Capitals and Penguins series, we start with the hit that Matt Niskanen laid on Sidney Crosby after the slash by Alex Ovechkin. Did it deserve supplemental discipline? Was it filthy dirty? Was it a dirty play, but reasonable in the light of Stanley Cup playoff dirtiness? Your thoughts on the Sidney Crosby injury, the slash, and then the hit by Niskanen?
Yeah, well, and you just mentioned the slash, Drew. You could argue that the slash by Ovechkin was worse than the Niskanen cross-check, right? But, I mean, look, it's a cross-check to the face from Matt Niskanen. And Sidney Crosby's falling. We've all watched the replay many times now. I don't think that Matt Niskanen ever intentionally tried to cross-check him in the face. I think he was going for the hit, and it happened so quickly. But you know, Alex Ovechkin slashes him across the arm and the shoulder and gets him up in the face, and Sidney Crosby's already going down, and then Niskanen adds insult to injury there, right, and gets him up in the face. So I don't think it was intentional, but it was dirty. Should he have been suspended? Maybe. But what are we talking about here, a game or two? And the worst part of this is that Sidney Crosby misses Game 4. The Penguins obviously pick up the 3-2 win.
Mm-hmm.
But now Crosby has another concussion, and now he's up to 4 concussions in his career. And now are we talking about a Paul Kariya or Eric Lindros situation, right? So, I mean, he's skating on his own now. He's been skating at the Penguins practice facility. He
took line rushes with them yesterday in practice.
Yep, so he could play in Game 5 tonight, Drew. But, I mean, what for me is the most surprising about this series is the Capitals have outshot the Penguins every game. Mm-hmm. And in this game, the shots were 2-1. Obviously, they weren't 2-1. They were 38-19, but, you know, that's a fraction that I'm using there.
Yeah.
But it's from the John Ginsberg School of Mathematics.
There you
exactly.
Go.
Uh-huh. But when you're talking about the Capitals, I mean, they've really outplayed the Penguins for stretches of this series.
Does Braden Holtby need to steal one or two of the games? I mean, does he need to steal the next two games to put him into a Game 7?
Well, you know, it's the old adage, right? A goalie needs to steal you a series in order to win the Stanley Cup, right? And mm-hmm. certainly he didn't steal the first round against the Toronto Maple Leafs. Holtby was good, but I would argue that Freddie Anderson was better than Braden Holtby in that first round. And
given the expectations each had on them, yep. I would suggest you're probably right.
And Drew, I'm not saying Braden Holtby has been bad in this series, but Marc-Andre Fleury has been better. Mm-hmm. And just look at the shots. I mean, Marc-Andre Fleury is playing excellent right now. And, you know, you look at the Capitals, and, I mean, we can't not talk about Game 4 without talking about TJ Oshie's phantom high stick on Nick Bonino. I mean, that was a terrible call.
Yeah.
He doesn't get Nick Bonino at all, and Nick Bonino sells it. And, you know, I got to say, I've said this many times on the show before, I really like Nick Bonino's game, but it's unfortunate because with less than 2 minutes in the game, the Capitals are pushing for the tying goal, and they're shorthanded. Right? So they pulled their goalie at that point, but now it's 5-on-5.
They're shorthanded as a result of the phantom call on TJ
Oshie.
Right,
and it's very hard, and you could see that really deflated the Washington Capitals, right? And so, I mean, that call was unfortunate, but let's be honest here. The Capitals aren't burying their chances. I mean, they had a lot of chances in this game, and I didn't think it was Alex Ovechkin's best game. I thought the best forward for the Washington Capitals was probably Evgeny Kuznetsov. But I mean, Alex Ovechkin has to be better. I mean, Nicklas Backstrom and TJ Oshie and Ovechkin on that line. I mean, they've been good throughout the playoffs. But I mean, this is your time to beat the Penguins. You've got no Sidney Crosby. You've got no Chris Letang. Mm-hmm. They've already lost twice to the Penguins in the two previous times they've played them in the playoffs.
No Connor Sheary.
And no Connor Sheary, right? So, I mean, what else are you waiting for here? I mean, the Capitals are down 3-1. And if they don't do it, if they don't beat the Penguins this year, when are they going to beat the Penguins?
Well, I think that Game 4 was the critical game for Washington to win. I mean, it sounds obvious, but I mean, if you can set it up 2-all with all those injuries that Ezra just illustrated versus going down 3-1 mm-hmm. and having to do almost the improbable, and whether Sidney Crosby plays in Game 5 or not, I think this series is over. And it's interesting, Barry Trotz was doing some gamemanship on Friday at Capitals practice. He had dropped Alex Ovechkin down to the third line and put Burakovsky up to the first line. Mm-hmm. Now, that's likely because he's going to probably double shift Ovechkin more than he's going to drop him down the third line. He'll probably have him playing on the third line to get him some more opportunities to get him going offensively. But it's interesting that's what happened, because of course people are like, why is Alex Ovechkin? Because in with Washington, the top six wear a red jersey and the bottom six forwards will wear like a white jersey at practice.
Ovechkin was wearing
white and Burakovsky was wearing red.
And then today at practice at the game day skate, Ovechkin was wearing red.
Yeah, of course, of course. But I'm just saying, like, it's yesterday. Just gamesmanship. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, you see the trying to somewhat change the narrative and have people talking about that as opposed to perhaps the, you know, the game four, the miss by Washington, because that's a swing and a miss. And the fact is that, you know, you mentioned it earlier when you're asking Michael Tracos about whether the Penguins are their bugaboo. I think there's no question. I mean, if you're the Pittsburgh Penguins and you're missing all of those players who have really helped get you to this point, especially Sidney Crosby, I mean, you can't overlook him. Then how are you going to beat this Pittsburgh Penguins team? And the answer is, I don't think you're going to. And even if you win Game 5 somehow, you're going to lose in Game 6.
If the Capitals, you know, fall at the hands of the Penguins, and I think everybody in this room would expect the Penguins with a 3-1 lead are probably going to win the series. Mm-hmm. Do the Capitals have to do something dramatic, or would that just be an overreaction? And again, you just sort of throw your hands up in the air and say, something about the Penguins, we can't, you know, it's a, you know, back, if you'll forgive me for a curling analogy, a comparison here.
None of us will understand it.
Fair enough. The audience will. Mike McEwen was one of the greatest curlers in the world.
And hurry hard, Drew.
Is one of the greatest curlers in the world.
Freeze.
But for the longest time, he could never get past Jeff Stoughton to win Manitoba and represent Manitoba at the Brier. What happened was Stoughton ended up losing in the semifinals a couple years ago, and McEwen was then able to sort of avoid Stoughton and ended up winning that way. Is that what the Capitals need? They just need somebody else to do their dirty work for them in defeating the Penguins or having the Penguins fall to someone else, and that'll be how the Capitals get to the next level?
I don't know if it's about someone doing the dirty work, Drew. I mean, it's about elevating your game. I mean, Pittsburgh is the defending Stanley Cup champions, right? And they got whooped in Game 2, 6-2 by the Penguins. Game 3, the Caps won in overtime, and last game was fairly even. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the Penguins at times dictated the pace, and that's without Sidney Crosby in the lineup. But, I mean, Alex Ovechkin's got a goal and two assists in this series. He wasn't very good in Game 4, but I don't think that that's necessarily been the problem. I mean, Braden Holtby asked to outplay Marc-Andre Fleury. I think that's what it's come down to. Even without Crosby in the lineup, Pittsburgh has a lot of weapons. Evgeny Malkin, Phil Kessel, Jake Guentzel is leading the playoffs in goal scoring, right? So I think he is, or Ryan Getzlaff might be leading now. But the Penguins have a lot of offensive weapons. And, you know, we know Braden Holtby's a top goaltender in the league right now, but Marc-Andre Fleury, I think, is in their heads because you remember, even go back to 2009, who was in net for the Pittsburgh Penguins against the Washington Capitals? It was Marc-Andre Fleury. Last year was Matt Murray, but for me, Marc-Andre Fleury has been the MVP of this series. So, I mean, Washington's played well. If you've watched the four games, and I've watched every game of this series, I mean, Washington is creating chances. I mean, they are all over the ice, and it's not just the top line with Ovechkin, Oshie, and Backstrom. I mean, the second line with Justin Williams, Marcus Johansson. I mean, they've been, and who am I missing there? Kuznetsov. Mm-hmm. They're creating chances as well. So it's not like the Washington Capitals aren't getting their chances. Marc-Andre Fleury has just been that good. So, I mean, it's going to be another close game. It could go to overtime. But, I mean, Washington right now, they have to play desperate. What they do have in their advantage is home ice, obviously.
Sure.
And they have the last change and all that. But I think this series is going back to Pittsburgh for Game 6.
I think Marc-Andre Fleury had the ultimate stroke of gamesmanship when he covered over Matt Niskanen's name on the back of his goalie mask. And
that was funny.
And to your earlier point, too, and I'll kind of wrap it up, I guess, I think Braden Holtby has to be the difference. And he hasn't been so far. This is a President's Cup winning team. They were clearly the best team in the regular season. How is it that they've fallen off the rails so hard, so quickly in the playoffs?
They've won the President's Trophy 2 years in a row now.
Exactly. And they won by 7 points over Pittsburgh. And so you've got to think to yourself, this is a very good hockey team. They're not slouches. They can score. They can play defense. They just aren't doing it very well right now. So, I mean, but it's going to start with your goaltender. If Braden Holtby can play like Braden Holtby does, then we could talk about maybe getting to a Game 6. I still don't think it's going to matter because I think Pittsburgh's winning it.
When we come back, Josh Smith of ScoutingTheRefs.com joins us to talk about the performance of the men in stripes thus far in the playoffs. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.